started this evening. We are going to be talking about wisdom psalms. Before I get into that, let me say a couple things about this class moving forward before I forget to. Next week will be the last week of this portion of our psalms class. You remember, I imagine, because I've mentioned it from time to time, that we're basically taking the last two-thirds of this year and dividing it up, talking about the psalms between a kind of introductory class that we've been doing where we talk about different kinds of psalms and look at examples and those kinds of things. And then a class on individual psalms where we'll focus specifically on some. And the way that was planned to be done is as a sign-up kind of situation where whoever wants to is willing to can teach a class. I posted a sign-up sheet this evening. So if you want to look at your schedule and look at the Wednesdays that are hanging up, look at the psalms that are your favorites perhaps and choose one and sign up for a day, that would be great. Obviously, we have people that can fill in those gaps as are needed, but this is a good opportunity for people that want to, you know, get their feet wet in teaching perhaps but don't want to commit to 4 months of it to get an opportunity to do that kind of thing. I've also included on the sign-up sheet, you'll see when you get back there, a list of the psalms that we've covered in this portion of the class. I'm not going to tell you what you can and can't do. Obviously, that's not my place. But I think, in my judgment, it seems best not to just duplicate all the ones that we've talked about, however brief we've been in talking about them. We've talked about roughly 50 psalms, so there's a whole lot more material out there to cover in the 20 weeks that we'll have left this year. So take a look at that and think about that, and if you're willing to teach one or two of those, that would be fantastic. I'm hoping also we get some college students that may be willing to do some of that as well, but be thinking about that over the next couple weeks, perhaps. Well, before we start tonight, let's begin with a word of prayer. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you for who you are and for what you teach us, that you have shown us the way of wisdom, and that is to fear you and keep your commandments. And Father, we ask that those would be the guiding principles of our lives as we seek to honor you and to live in a way that is pleasing to you. Be with us in our study and help our minds and hearts to be open to your word and help it to shape us that we would be the people that we should be. In your Son we pray. Amen. All right, the last two kinds of psalms that we'll talk about, wisdom psalms today and then Torah psalms or law psalms next week, are a little bit different. Sometimes they're referred to, perhaps a little tongue-in-cheek, as psalms that are not psalms. And the reason that they're talked about this way is because they're different from basically the rest of the kinds of psalms that have been talked about along the way. Broadly speaking, you can group everything that we've talked about into laments and psalms of praise. Now it gets a little bit more specific than that, but penitential psalms and imprecatory psalms are kind of like laments, and psalms of trust and psalms of thanksgiving and psalms of the king broadly fit into the idea of praise or positive kinds of psalms. So using that kind of broad framework, laments are prayers directed to God, obviously, and praises are praise addressed to God, and so most of the psalms that you see in the Psalter are prayers. They are talking to God, whether things are good or things are bad, or you're talking about the king, or you're talking about your faith, or you're giving thanks, or whatever it may be, they're prayers to God. But there are a few psalms that are different, that don't contain address to God. And that's what these last couple of kinds of psalms fit into this category. Instead of being prayers, they're reflections. Instead of talking to God, they're talking perhaps about God or about things of God. They have a purpose that is instructive to teach people things about whatever it is that they may be talking about. Now, to be fair here, most psalms are of a mixed character. You read a lament, and it has an instructive purpose as well as being a prayer. It teaches you things in that kind of context. And very often some of these prayers that are, or some of these psalms that are reflections, there may be an address to God of one kind or another along the way. But it's really obviously something of a sliding scale, and it falls far more heavily on the prayer side or far more heavily on the reflection side, and that's part of what makes it different. And also, it's the content of the psalm that makes it different. There's no particular structure that, you know, if it follows this particular structure, then it's a psalm of praise or a psalm of lament, but if it follows this other structure, it's just what's in the psalm itself that tells you whether it's addressing God or it's addressing the people who are followers of God. So those are the kinds of things that we'll be considering as we look at these last two kinds of psalms over the next couple weeks. Now, there are other kinds that could fit into this kind of category. There are some psalms that are kind of hard to narrow down and pigeonhole exactly what they may be. But the two big kinds of reflective psalms are wisdom psalms and Torah psalms. And that's what we'll spend our time talking about tonight and next week, respectively. A third kind that sometimes gets put in here that I'm not going to have a class on. There just aren't that many, and they're a lot more straightforward as far as seeing what's going on in them, are historical psalms. That may be something some people want to track down a few of those and cover those in the class. Those basically, you know, talk about the history of Israel and teach from it. They're fascinating psalms, but it's, you know, beyond just talking about those psalms, which is what we're going to be doing for the next 20 weeks, there's really not enough to build a class on what does a historical psalm look like. Well, it looks like a history of Israel with some teaching. And so that's why we're not doing those specifically, but there will be time. Now, what is it in wisdom psalms specifically that marks them as wisdom psalms? And as we've been saying all along, remember, it's not a situation where psalmists were following some prescribed list. You know, they flip through their book of different kinds of psalms, and aha, here's wisdom psalm. It has these five things. I better include them all. It's all poetry. It's all pouring their heart out in one way or another, and they just don't follow that kind of listing in poetry. And so some of these will have some of these traits, some will have others, but generally speaking, what makes them wisdom psalms is they have the traits of wisdom literature. The three main wisdom books of the Old Testament are Job, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes. We talked about Job already this year. Proverbs and Ecclesiastes are slated for next year, so we'll get our taste of that as we go on. But these wisdom psalms have some of those kinds of traits. One of the main things that they have very frequently are proverbial statements, proverbs, in some of these psalms, as we will see. And some of the ways that proverbial statements show themselves are uses, frequent uses of simile, and in particular, analogies from nature. Now, not all of those are expressly proverbs, but that is the kind of thing that fits nicely into being a proverbial statement. And then also specifically, blessed sayings and better than sayings, which are two particular kinds of proverbial statements. So, blessed is the man who does such and such is a typical proverbial statement, and a better than saying, which is not, you know, this is better than that, directly tied together, but usually better is this than that. So it will usually have that kind of form, as we will see. And then in addition to that, there are what you might call key wisdom themes, the sorts of things that the books of wisdom concern themselves with repeatedly are found in these wisdom psalms as well. So, for example, the two ways. You may remember, perhaps, or if you don't, I'm sure you will after next year. In Proverbs 1 through 9, basically what you have is a long discourse on the two ways. You have the way of God and the way of folly, the way of wisdom, the way of folly, the way of the of lady wisdom, the way of woman folly. And over and over and over are these two paths clearly specified, and you've got to choose one path or the other. You're on the path of the righteous or you're on the path of the wicked. Those themes we will see. A reflection on the problem of evil. This is something that people still concern themselves with to a great deal today. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do the wicked prosper? Those kinds of ideas we will see discussed. This, of course, is a whole lot like the book of Ecclesiastes in some places. Like the book of Job, of course, has a lot of that theme as well. Specifically, the fear of the Lord will show up from time to time in the wisdom psalms. Of course, this is a key wisdom theme. The book of Proverbs begins by saying the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The book of Job has as its center point, this is wisdom, fear God and keep His commandments. The book of Ecclesiastes ends with the fear of the Lord, as the essence of what Ecclesiastes is all about there as it wraps up. So we'll find this in the wisdom psalms as well. And finally, what you might just call practical advice for daily living. I'm sure there's probably some deeper things going on in this than that, but you think of the book of Proverbs, and again, while a lot of it goes beyond just practical advice for daily living, there's a lot of good practical advice for daily living in the book of Proverbs, and you'll find that in these wisdom psalms as well. So I'll put this slide back up from time to time as we go, because what I really want to do tonight, as we talk about these, of course, we're welcome to talk about them in whatever ways you'd like to comment on them. But what I'd like to do is read a few of these psalms, show you a basic outline of how they're put together, maybe make a few brief comments. But I want you, as we read through these, to try to find these traits in these psalms, to see just how they are wisdom psalms that bear these traits. And as you see that, I think that will help you understand the psalms themselves better as we go along. So, Psalm 37 is where we will begin. Yes, go ahead, Greg.
Real quick, the but statements, you know, such and such, but the meaning.
Yes.
That
would be in the proverbial statements is where that would be found. Yeah, just a different kind of proverbial statement. And there's probably, if you know, we sat down and thought about all the different kinds of proverbial statements in wisdom and that show up here, there's more than just that. That's just kind of an idea of some of the more frequent ones. Any other thoughts? All right, Psalm 37 is where we'll begin. Psalm 37, I'll mention here at the beginning, this is an acrostic poem by double verse, more or less. Our numbering in English translation falters. There's 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Your translation has 40 verses instead of 44, and so our numbering breaks down. But basically, by double verse, verses 1 and 2 start with Aleph, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Verses 3 and 4 start with Beth, and so forth and so on. And so that's what's going on in this psalm in terms of its structure, as far as that goes. As you will see, this is essentially an exposition of Jesus' third beatitude, of course, written long in advance. This is what Jesus is drawing from, thinking about. Of course, as you know, God who inspired the psalmist, he was the original author of this. But this helps us understand to some degree what it means that the meek will inherit the earth. So bear that in mind as well as we read our way through this. Verse 1, fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers, for they will fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in Him, and He will act. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for Him. Fret not yourself over the one who prospers in his way, over the man who carries out evil devices. Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not yourself, it tends only to evil. For the evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land. In just a little while the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. But the meek shall inherit the land, and delight themselves in abundant peace. The wicked plots against the righteous, and gnashes his teeth at him. But the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he sees that his day is coming. The wicked draws the sword and bend their bows to bring down the poor and needy, to slay those whose way is upright. Their sword shall enter their own heart, and their bows shall be broken. Better is the little that the righteous has than the abundance of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Lord upholds the righteous. The Lord knows the days of the blameless, and their heritage will remain forever. They are not put to shame in evil times. In the days of famine they have abundance. But the wicked will perish. The enemies of the Lord are like the glory of the pastures. They vanish, like smoke they vanish away. The wicked borrows, but does not pay back. But the righteous is generous and gives. For those blessed by the Lord shall inherit the land, but those cursed by him shall be cut off. The steps of a man are established by the Lord when he delights in his way. Though he fall, he shall not be cast headlong, for the Lord upholds his hand. I have been young, and now am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, or his children begging for bread. He is ever lending generously, and his children become a blessing. Turn away from evil and do good. So shall you dwell forever. For the Lord loves justice. He will not forsake his saints. They are preserved forever. But the children of the wicked shall be cut off. Their righteous shall inherit the land and dwell upon it forever. The mouth of the righteous utters wisdom, and his tongue speaks justice. The law of his God is in his heart, and his steps do not slip. The wicked watches for the righteous and seeks to put him to death. The Lord will not abandon him to his power or let him be condemned when he is brought to trial. Wait for the Lord and keep his way, and he will exalt you to inherit the land. You will look on when the wicked are cut off. I have seen a wicked, ruthless man spreading himself like a green laurel tree. But he passed away, and behold, he was no more. Though I sought him, he could not be found. Mark the blameless, and behold the upright. For there is a future for the man of peace, but transgressors shall be altogether destroyed. The future of the wicked shall be cut off. The salvation of the righteous is from the Lord. He is their stronghold in the time of trouble. The Lord helps them and delivers them. He delivers them from the wicked and saves them because they take refuge in him. All right. Verses 1 through 11 here is really the first main part of this psalm, and there seems to be three basic ideas that run through this. First, an idea of looking to the future rather than focusing necessarily on the here and now. You find that in several places. Verse 2, the wicked will soon fade like grass. Verse 7, wait patiently for the Lord. Verse 9, the evildoers will be cut off. So this idea of a forward-looking sort of perspective is one of the main ideas. But also not just looking forward to the future, but looking upward toward God, knowing that He is the one who is really in control. And that is what really dominates the bulk of this section from verses 3 through 7. Trust in the Lord, delight yourself in the Lord, commit your way to the Lord, be still before the Lord. All of those ideas are so prominent here in this section. And then also, meanwhile, to be constructive. You're looking to the future, you're looking to God, and as this time passes, do something worthwhile. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness in verse 3. Refrain from evil, forsake wrath. Fret not yourself, it tends only to evil in verse 8. Verses 12 through 26 is a long section that compares the fortunes and the ways of the wicked and the righteous, really from an outside kind of perspective, looking at those things. And then finally, verses 27 through 40 is what you might call the long view, really looking off into the future and saying that regardless of how it may seem now, God is the one who is going to take care of everything. The word forever, or a synonym of it, shows up quite frequently in this section. The focus on the stress on, or the focus on posterity through this section as well speaks to this kind of long view of looking at things, which is to say it's thinking ahead to afterwards, to the end, all of those kinds of things. That's basically how this psalm is put together as I see it, what the main sections are and what's going on in them. Charlie. It could be in some regards. There certainly is a fair amount of trust in it. I mean, right out of the gate in verse 3, trust in the Lord. What makes it a wisdom psalm instead of a trust psalm is how frequently these things show up in it. So that's a good segue. It may be a trusting wisdom psalm, perhaps, as a way of talking about it. And again, it's best not to be too rigid in our categorization of these things. But that's a nice segue, I think, into asking the question. Looking at Psalm 37, as you read it with me or heard it perhaps, what are some of the things from our list of traits of wisdom psalms that stood out to you as we worked through this? Anything in particular? Verse 16, better is the little that the righteous has than the abundance of many wicked. That's straight out of the book of Proverbs, that kind of statement. Proverbial statement, specifically a better than proverbial statement. So that's a good starting point. What else here?
This reads like a proverb.
Yeah, a lot of places it does. It has a lot of those traits. It wouldn't fit very well into, say, Proverbs 10 through 31, where you've got these pithy little wisdom sayings. But if you took this and exported it from Psalms and you dropped it in the middle of Proverbs 1 through 9, it fit really well into those lengthy wisdom poems from the father to his son. Yeah, it reads a lot like those. Anything else stand out to you? Okay, so there's one spot. In fact, there's a whole lot of spots the righteous versus the wicked are compared. So I got a couple of hands. If y'all aren't talking about that, we'll come back to it in a second. Greg?
Along that same line, righteous and wicked, it says don't worry about the wicked, they're going to pass away.
Okay.
Wait on the Lord, take care.
Okay, Jonathan?
The whole psalm feels a lot less cohesive than a lot of other psalms we've looked at. Okay.
Yeah, one of the things that I don't have on the list that kind of marks this kind of reflection is observational wisdom. You see this a lot in Ecclesiastes, and you see it here, verse 35, I have seen a wicked, ruthless man spreading himself. I mean, that's the sort of thing that is straight out of wisdom literature as well, is I've lived and I experienced things, and I've seen this, and let me tell you where this leads.
Also, I am young and now I'm old.
Yep. Yep, that goes along with that as well. All right, so to this idea of the two ways, the righteous and the wicked, by my count of the 40 verses, about 20 of them have some reference to this theme of righteous and wicked. Sometimes it's, like Charlie said, not as explicit. It mentions one and the others there kind of by implication. But this is a major, major theme that runs through this. Let me start by asking if there's any verses in particular that jump out to you before I go into a list of these of my own. Anything that stands out to you as part of this righteous versus wicked theme? Yeah. Well, it does have the blameless there in verse 18. So verses 18 through 20 is one of the sections that I have marked for that. The Lord knows the day of the wicked, of the blameless. Their heritage will remain forever. They're not put to shame, but the wicked will perish. I think that's a pretty strong contrast between the righteous and the wicked there in those verses. 37 and 38, yeah, definitely this fits there as well. Mark the blameless, behold the upright, but transgressors shall be altogether destroyed. Yeah. Verse 12 and in verse 13, along with that, the wicked plots against the righteous, but the Lord laughs at the wicked. He said 16 and 17, better is the little that the righteous has than the abundance of many wicked, for the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Lord upholds the righteous. And there's a lot more. Verse 7 has this idea. Verse 9 has this idea as well. Verse 21, verse 22, verse 33, verse 34. So this is a major, major theme that runs through this. the fact that it shows up so frequently probably gives you an idea that this is one of the main ideas. I mean, half of the verses of the psalm are dealing with this theme. So that's probably the main point of this psalm, I think it's safe to say. Charlie? Right, and that is, I think, verses 3 and 4 of admonishing the righteous to trust in the Lord and dwell in the land and delight yourself in the Lord is set in contrast with verses 1 and 2, which is don't worry about the evildoers. Even when it's not as overt of a there are two ways, the righteous and the wicked, it's still what lies behind so much of this psalm. All right, Brother Winton caught one of our proverbial statements, verse 16, better is little that the righteous has than the abundance of many wicked. Verse 21 is another proverbial statement along those same kinds of lines. The wicked borrows but does not pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. I mean, if I just put that verse on a card all by itself, we haven't read this psalm, I say I put on the PowerPoint, put it up there, and I ask you, what book of the Bible does this come from? Most of you would probably guess Proverbs. Because that sounds like it comes right out of the book of Proverbs. So again, that kind of proverbial statement fits into that as well. Similes of nature. Any of you catch the similes of nature as we went through? Okay, 2:20 and 35. They will soon fade like grass. Grass is the word I'm looking for. Verse 20. The glory of the pastures, like smoke, they vanish away. Verse 35, spreading himself like a green laurel tree. Again, that's all very reminiscent of wisdom literature. You might add to that verse 6 as well. Bring forth your righteousness as light and your justice as the noonday. A little bit more of a subtle kind of reference to nature, but the same kind of idea there as well. What else? Anything else, Greg? Yeah. Right. And in particular, that's almost certainly a reference to the promised land that was the inheritance of the people. It's still a reference to something in nature itself going on there. Anything else that strikes you as wisdom-like in this psalm? Yeah, and what I'd say about a lot of those is they, I think, could kind of boil down to this idea of these practical admonitions for kind of spiritual daily living, you might say. Verse 1, don't fret because of evildoers. Verse 3, trust in the Lord. Verse 4, delight yourself in the Lord. Verse 5, commit your way to the Lord. Verse 8, refrain from anger, forsake wrath. Fret not yourself, it tends only to evil. I mean, that's just good practical advice is what that is if you're going to be following God. And so those kinds of statements that sound like they fit very well in wisdom literature because they're good practical wisdom kinds of statements that you find in wisdom literature. So, kind of looking at this psalm, like I say, I think it helps us when we kind of stop and look at the wisdom aspect of it, really see what's going on in the psalm, particularly this overriding theme of the two ways, the righteous and the wicked, contrasted. And here, the main idea isn't just, there are some righteous and there are some wicked, and you have to make a choice, like it is in Proverbs 1 through 9, but there are wicked that seem to be doing pretty well, and you're righteous. What you need to do is not worry about them. You need to keep trusting in God and committing yourself to Him and know that He's going to take care of everything in the end. And that's where this two ways righteous wicked is really going to settle itself down in this psalm. Charlie?
I have a question that may not be able to be answered.
Okay.
There's no mention of like the forefathers and
visualize, even though we have this progression, usually when we see those two things together, we usually get Father, Son, and there somewhere. And is there a reason why, or is it just something that David decided not to write about, or is it supposed to imply something?
Yeah, I don't know that I can't answer that. You know, when he doesn't come right out and expressly say why he's not. On the other hand, you know, it's the sort of thing perhaps that if it was the same psalm written in a different genre, if it was a Torah psalm instead of a wisdom psalm, there'd be a lot of references to Moses and probably on back before that as well. If it was the psalm of thanksgiving, it might call to mind Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the great things God did for them. One of the things about wisdom literature itself is that it's pretty devoid of those Israelite kinds of ideas. I mean, there's not a whole lot of reference to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in Job, Proverbs, or Ecclesiastes as far as that goes. And so it may be just part of the nature of wisdom literature that it's more universal, and that may be what's going on here. It's just the nature of the genre of wisdom. Jonathan, were you going to say something? Yeah, I mean, I think you can make an argument that the references to the land showing up would be understood as being Israel-specific, but it's still, I think, vague enough that if somebody who wasn't an Israelite was reading it, they would benefit from it even without the land promise, per se. Yeah, yeah. All right. Adam, were you going to say something? All right, well, let's move on to Psalm 49, just so we'll have some time to talk about the last one at least, because the last one's my favorite one. I'm not sure why I put it, well, if I put it first, we wouldn't talk about anything else. I guess that's why I put it last. Psalm 49 has something of an inverse outline, as we can see here. It has an introductory kind of section that lays out what's going on in the first four verses. And then there's a question in verses 5 and 6, and the resolution to the question at the end in verses 15 through 20. And then the middle section deals with the certainty of death and the folly of riches. So Psalm 49, "Hear this, all peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor, together. My mouth shall speak wisdom, the meditation of my heart shall be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb, I will solve my riddles with the music of the lyre. Why should I fear in times of trouble, when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me? Those who trust in their wealth and boast in the abundance of their riches. Truly, no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life. For the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice, that he should live on forever and never see the pit. For he sees that even the wise die, the fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their homes forever, their generation or their dwelling places to all generations, though they called lands by their own names. Man in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence, yet after them people approve of their boasts. Like sheep they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Be not afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases. For when he dies, he will carry nothing away. His glory will not go down after him. For though while he lives, he counts himself blessed, and though you get praise when you do well for yourself, his soul will go to the generation of his fathers who will never see light again. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. Well, the theme of this psalm sounds a whole lot like the book of Ecclesiastes, there is this thing that follows all of us everywhere, and you meet it in Ecclesiastes on nearly every page, and it renders everything vain in Ecclesiastes. And that thing that follows us all everywhere is the reality of death, that it's the great equalizer at the end. You remember that bumper sticker that was going around back in, I guess, probably the 80s, he who dies with the most toys wins. And then there was the subsequent follow-up rebuttal bumper sticker, which usually rebuttal bumper stickers are pretty stupid, but this one was fantastic. It said, he who dies with the most toys still dies. And that's kind of the reality of the situation in Ecclesiastes. That's the reality of the situation here in Psalm 49 as well. It does bring out an assurance of victory, I think, that Ecclesiastes does not touch on nearly as much here in this psalm. In particular, verse 15 is something of a high point of Old Testament hope in terms of an afterlife of what's coming, you know, after we die, which is the Old Testament is really pretty silent about, and there's a lot of questions as to what they believed about the afterlife. Well, verse 15 is one of the glimmers of light in that discussion. God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. That's the kind of statement you don't really find anywhere in Ecclesiastes. But you do find this here. So, with that little bit of background, and again, we can talk more specifically about the psalm. Let's start, though, by talking about some of the wisdom traits of this psalm and see if that helps us see anything as to what's going on here. What strikes you in this psalm as being very wisdom-centric? Jonathan? Yeah, the subject of riches, and in particular, riches in the hands of the wicked. Seems to be the main idea here. What else? Okay, verses 16 and 17. Don't be afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house increases. When he dies, he will carry nothing away, for his glory will not go down after him. You know, that and even on really into verses 17, 18, and 19, or verses 18 and 19, I should say, that's kind of more of this practical admonitions. Good spiritual wisdom could fit into that category, perhaps. Jonathan?
The beginning of the psalm is reminiscent of places, and especially the first nine chapters of the Proverbs, where somebody's like, hey, listen to me, I'm going to tell you about wisdom.
Right. Also, a lot like the introductions to the speeches in Job. Yeah, listen to me, I'm going to teach you wisdom. Now, how much of that they were actually doing in Job is a different matter. But, I mean, that's a typical kind of introduction to a wisdom speech. And so that does fit in here. And also, I mean, my mouth will speak wisdom. My heart shall be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will solve the riddle. All of that is good wisdom verbiage that's being used there in that introductory section as well. Okay, yeah. Right. And riddle solving in the ancient world was a form of wisdom. I mean, it was something that was grouped in with wisdom teaching and wisdom in general. Brother Winton?
Verse 20,
yeah.
Fitting finale.
It is.
And it may be proof that beasts don't have souls.
Yeah, perhaps. It's also another one of those verses that if I put it on the slide by itself, you'd probably have a hard time guessing which book of the Bible it came out of. That's one that I would put clearly in the proverbial statement category. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beast that perish. I mean, you might guess Ecclesiastes instead of Proverbs, but it's still that very clear proverbial kind of wisdom. Charlie?
Is verse 12 and verse 20 supposed to be the same statement?
Verse 12 and verse 20. Man in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beast that perish. It's certainly variation on a theme, if nothing else. Yeah, the same basic idea there. And they're both also similes of nature, as far as that goes, by the way.
Contrast between 7 and 18.
Okay, no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life. Verse 18, you said? 15, but God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol. He will receive me. I don't know that that is specifically wisdom-centric, but that's a great contrast to pick up on and notice what's going on in that. Jonathan?
The comparison of people to sheep.
Yeah, verse 14, another comparison of nature there. Running out of time way too fast. What else? Anything else here? Well, this psalm, I would say as a whole, is perhaps not a significant one as we might think about it, but really it's a meditation on the problems of life in verses 5 through 20. Really in the heart of it, 7 through 14, as he seeks the answer to this question, 7 through 20, you might say, that makes it at least something of a meditation on the problem of evil. What do I do in times of trouble? Why should I fear? What about it when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me? People who trust in their wealth? And that's the question, that's what gets answered, and that's what gets discussed in the middle section, which again tells you something about this psalm in particular of what's going on through the heart of it. And you can see in these kinds of different little ways how this is answered and how the wisdom pieces of this psalm help guide us to that answer that he's seeking. All right, well, we'll start into Psalm 73, and I don't know how much time we'll have to talk about it. Basically, this is two main parts to this psalm. It begins with an introductory verse, and it's one of those things where the first verse gives the answer away before he really gets to dealing with problem, which in, you know, American writing, that's not a good thing to do. I mean, you want to keep the suspense up as long as you can and then give it away at the end. Well, that's not how Hebrew writing worked very frequently at all. They often had summary sentences at the beginning of a narrative that tell you basically everything that's going to follow in one short sentence. Sometimes in writing like this, where there's going to be a big question and a big answer, they'll tell you the answer first before they get into it. And the reason that I mention that is because it almost seems disjointed as you begin with truly God is good to Israel and to those who are pure in heart. And then immediately he starts talking as if God is not good to those in Israel and to those who are pure in heart. It's because he's telling you at the outset the conclusion that he's come to, and then he's going to tell you how he got to that point. So that's what we're going to find in this psalm. So, continuing then in verse 2, as for me, my feet had almost stumbled, my steps had nearly slipped, for I was envious of the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. For they have no pangs until death, their bodies are fat and sleek, they are not in trouble as others are. They are not stricken like the rest of mankind. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them as a garment. Their eyes swell out through fatness, and their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against the heavens, and their tongue struts through the earth. Therefore, his people turn back to them and find no fault in them. And they say, how can God know? Is there knowledge in the Most High? Behold, behold, these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches. All in vain I have kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. For all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning. If I had said, I will speak thus, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task, until I went into the sanctuary of God, and then I discerned their end. Truly, you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. How they are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors, like a dream when one awakes. O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. When my soul was embittered, when I was pricked in heart, I was brutish and ignorant. I was like a beast toward you. Nevertheless, I am continually with you. You hold my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the rock of my heart and my portion forever. For behold, those who are far from you shall perish. You put an end to everyone who is unfaithful to you. But for me it is good to be near God. I have made the Lord God my refuge, that I may tell all your works. Well, here he says, basically, he looked around, he saw the plight of the righteous and how great everything seemed for the wicked, and he almost slips. That's in verse 2, verses 13 and 14, but ultimately he doesn't. He stops himself from thinking this way and says, if I had thought this way, I would have betrayed the generation of your children. But he also says that this is a difficult thing to understand, that this is not an easy matter to work through until you look at it in the context of God. It seemed to be a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God, and this perspective of looking at all of this through the lens of focus on God turns the world upside down. He says in verse 2, my steps had nearly slipped. And when he goes into the sanctuary of God, he sees that you have truly set them in slippery places in verse 18. Well, again, this is just a fantastic psalm. We could talk about this probably for the next entire class. But as we look at it from this perspective one more time, what are some things that strike you as being wisdom-like and help us understand what's going on?
I have a question.
Yes, by all means. Yes. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I could see it being either one of those and having a profound impact on him either way. I just don't know, to be sure. All right. Any other questions I can't answer? No. Go ahead, Brother Wynn.
Is God pleased with a wealthy, righteous person?
Well, if the righteous person is wealthy, he's only wealthy because God has given him that wealth. And as long as he's using it in a way that is rich toward God rather than rich toward himself, as you know, you see in the parable of the rich fool, I would say God is pleased with him.
We have Job.
Yeah, Job was a very wealthy person, and God was very pleased with him. Thank you. Yeah, Abraham is another one. All right, any particular wisdom themes striking to you here in Psalm 73? Yeah, Joy. It really does. That kind of experiential wisdom like Ecclesiastes. Jonathan?
It's spread out to have a longer form than a lot of Proverbs, but the whole idea of the wicked seem to have it good, but they really don't, is very much an idea you see in the Proverbs.
Yeah, it's a kind of a meditation on life in general, on the problem of evil in general, but also this righteous versus wicked is what runs through this. You're looking at the wicked specifically and how everything seems great for them, but there's also built into that how things don't necessarily seem so great for the righteous. They're not in trouble as others are. Well, if they're the wicked, who are the others in verse 5? Well, that would be the righteous who are in trouble by implication, I think, pretty clearly. And so there is that in verses 3 through 12 and a few other places as well. And also the idea of reward and punishment as it relates to righteous and wicked shows up here in this psalm. Also, one last thing that I'd point out here by way of wisdom in particular in this psalm are a couple of similes of nature that I think are profound ones. Like a dream when one awakes in verse 20, O Lord, when you rouse yourself, you despise them as phantoms. This is in the context of verse 19. They are destroyed in a moment, swept away utterly by terrors like a dream when one awakes. This is the reality of wealth. It's like a dream. And you stop and you think about that. the most vivid, realistic dream you've ever had in your life, even when it lingers with you for a few days, it's still very, very different from real life. And most dreams that you have, even when they're very real to you, when you first wake up, by the middle of the afternoon, you're trying to remember exactly what that dream was about. Dreams just, there's no substance to them at all. They have no lasting impact. I mean, you think of the millions of dreams you've had in your life, how many of them do you think about regularly? I remember that dream. Maybe something prompts you to remember a dream, but most of them you've completely forgotten about. There's a few that are in your mind, but that's the reality of wealth. It's like a dream that passes away. And then verse 22, and we'll end on this, I was brutish and ignorant, I was like a beast toward you. Another simile of nature, but in particular, that's striking back in the context of Psalm 49, man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beasts that perish. The fool is the beast in this idea of wisdom. And when he says, when I was thinking along these lines, when I was being brutish and ignorant, I was the fool, I was the beast, I was not acting with wisdom, I was being irrational, is the point of that particular analogy. Well, like I said, this is one that you would do well to meditate on this psalm the rest of the week. But we're out of time, and with a nod to Greg for giving me a couple of extra minutes. Torah Psalms next week. This should be easy for you to remember, Psalms 119 and 119. I think you should be able to handle those in particular. And then just one last reminder that starting in 2 weeks, we'll do the individual Psalms class. Sign-up sheets on the back if you want to look at that.